Well, good morning, everyone. It is good to see all of you out on this great day. I want to talk this morning a little bit about fatherhood. That isn't the lesson that I started with. You really don't want to know the tortured process that I go through sometimes in trying to decide what to speak on. I've got a lot of lessons kind of running around the back of my head, and then sort of late yesterday, it kind of dawned on me that today was Father's Day. And one thought led to another, and I first thought, well, you know, they get a Mother's Day lesson, and people go to Proverbs 31, and that's such a great chapter on mothers and whatnot. Let's go do one like that on fathers. And I started looking through. I couldn't find one. It's like, this started to get depressing. And we'll go through that in just a minute. Father's Day is an interesting day. It's set aside in this country as a day to celebrate honoring fathers and celebrating fatherhood, paternal bonds, the influence of fathers in society. But if you look up its origins, which I did yesterday, in this country, it started in 1907. There was a mining accident in West Virginia that killed 360 men. And it left 1,000 children fatherless. And so one of the wives decided that they needed to do something to honor that group of men. And that was kind of the beginnings of Father's Day. That was not an auspicious thing for me to find out as I'm trying to do this, is that all of them died in order to start looking to celebrate that. And then just think about, just start at the beginning. And for the first part of this lesson, I want to look at some of the examples of fathers that we had in the Bible. And then we'll talk a little bit more about responsibilities that fathers have. So a little bit down memory lane. Hopefully you'll know a little bit about your Old Testament. I'm not going to read a lot of passages, but I want you to think with me about what's going on. The first father that we know about was Adam. We don't really know much about his relationship with his children, except that one of them killed the other one. So I'm a little hesitant to look at that as a good example of fatherhood. Noah was probably a good example in many ways, to start out at least. You know, I think, although he was following God's command to build the ark, don't you think he also had in mind that he was saving his family and that this would preserve his children? So certainly there's an example of a father who not only provided for the well-being of his kids, but the safety of his kids and protection. And we'll talk about these three principles as we go along through here. And I call it, you know, it's provide, protect, and guide. And that's kind of what we're going to be looking at. But then, after he came off of the ark, and he set a really bad example. Got drunk in front of his kids, wound up cursing one of them and one of his grandsons, Ham and Canaan. Not a real good influence there. But, you know, we look at Job, and I think Job is a good example of a father that we have in the Bible. We don't see a lot about his relationship there, but the very opening when it talks about him, you notice there in the first part of Job, it talks about he offered sacrifices for his children. And the wording he says is, perhaps they have sinned. He was interested in their well-being and in doing what he could to try to keep them in the fold of God. And perhaps they have sinned. Now, he provided for them. We find out later on, he talks about his providing for his children. And in the very end of it, when it talks about even his daughters, he left an inheritance to his daughters, which is a little unusual back then, but that's the kind of dad that he was, in wanting to make sure that all of his children were taken care of. So Job is probably a pretty good example. How about Abraham? Where would you put Abraham in the classification as dads go? Well, mixed again, I think. He did pretty well with Isaac in a lot of ways and, you know, followed God and did what he could to prepare for the coming of Isaac. We also find that he was chosen. Take a look over in Genesis 18 and verse 19, if you want to turn over there. One of the reasons that he was chosen to be a leader in Israel was that he would teach his children. It says he would command his children and them after them to follow the Lord. And so he was an influence for good in his family. Kind of messed up a little bit with Ishmael. Okay, maybe there's other reasons going on there and things, but again, a little bit of a mixed example there. And what are the problems that he had with kind of stepping outside of the bounds of what he should have been as a father? And once he got involved with the handmaid, then we had the son that wound up not being able to stay with them. And how about Lot? There's an example that's really tough, isn't it? As you start looking back on it, as a man who moved to a city that was pretty corrupt. And we find out in Peter that it vexed Lot. He was trying to help, and he was known as a leader in that city. And so he had good intentions, I think, and the evil there bothered him. But it cost him his family. Lost his wife, lost his daughters. It was a little tough. How about Isaac? There was a son of Abraham. Surely he would have had a good example with his father, and yet he kind of played favorites, didn't he? You know, that was something that didn't go so well when he liked Esau better than Jacob, and the mom liked Jacob better than Esau. Where did that lead? All kinds of family strife and problems. Perhaps there's a lesson there we need to kind of look at, is if you have children, you know, playing favorites probably isn't the best policy. How about Jacob? Okay. Well, you know, started out kind of bad when he's deceiving his dad, and then he has to run from his brother. And then he did the same thing, played favorites with his sons. Benjamin and Joseph wound up being favorites. A lot of favoritism in that family that cost him in the long run. And then he had to run in with Laban. Remember Laban? How would you like it when, if your daughters said to you, as you know, when Jacob was trying to convince them it was time to go, his own daughters kind of looked at Jacob and said, "Let's pack up and leave. Our own father considers us foreigners." That's not a good epitaph either. Father considered us foreigners. But you know, there's an interesting good father mixed in there when we come into Moses. And I look at Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. Now, not only did he take Moses in, and Moses wound up marrying one of his daughters, but when he found out, you know, Moses had to send his family back for safekeeping, and when he found that it was they had come out of Egypt, he brought the family back to Moses. We don't hear anything about Moses, so we don't know how he interacted with his family. He had a lot of other concerns and things on his mind leading the people. But Jethro, I think, was a good example there, and then the advice that he gave Moses. Then we get into the period of the judges, and a lot of them we don't know, but everybody remember Jephthah? Not a good example there either. Yes, a rash vow that wound up costing his daughter. Not a good thing. And then how about Eli? A judge in Israel. A judge in Israel whose own sons were so corrupt that the people just couldn't stand it. And it wound up costing him his life and his son's life. They were so corrupt. Not a very good example there. And yet, the one who came along after him, Samuel, the chosen one, picked of God to do many great things. And Samuel was a great man. It says when he got into his old age, he appointed his sons as judge over Israel. And they were corrupt. Somehow there was something that was missing there. Something that didn't quite get there with Samuel. 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, verses 1 through 3. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. How about Saul, first king of Egypt? Egypt. I don't know where that came from. First king of Israel, right? First selected king after the judges. Samuel couldn't quite hack it and said, "Well, we want a king." So they picked Saul. He used his daughter as a political tool, tried to kill his son-in-law. Really messed up with Jonathan, his beloved son. He was so concerned with trying to get this kingdom to pass along. You know, I think he was trying to provide for his kids, but he kind of missed it going beyond that, right? And how about David? Now, there's one that breaks my heart, because David is known as a man after God's own heart. And David tried, and he had a lot of things on his plate, so I'll give him a little slack there. But whoa, what a messed up family. Had a son that raped one of his daughters and one of his other sons that wound up killing that son and then rebelling against him and trying to take his throne. Messed up. And then Solomon, one of the wisest men to ever live, and who gave some great advice in his book on Proverbs on raising children and things like that. And yet, I often wondered about him if he even knew all of his children. You know, with 300 wives and concubines and stuff, he probably just lost track of how many kids he even had around. And his oldest son, yeah, split the kingdom, lost it. So many bad examples. But you know, when you get into the New Testament, one of the first fathers that you run into is a really good example. Turn over to the book of Matthew. Matthew, the first chapter, it starts out and it gives the genealogy of Christ. And then it starts talking about the birth of Christ. And it says, now the birth of Christ was as follows. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found to be with child by the Holy Spirit. And Joseph, her husband, being a righteous man and not wanting to disgrace her, planned to send her away secretly. Now there's a man who could have gotten very indignant about this situation, was really faced with this, with something he wasn't sure what to do, because here's his betrothed wife and she's pregnant. Not a good thing. But notice what he says. He wanted to put her away quietly. He really didn't want to embarrass her. He didn't want to make a big deal out of this for her. And then when the angel came and told him what was going on, Joseph signed right up. And he goes, great, explanation. He calls him a righteous man. And there's the first quality that starts talking about what kind of father he's going to make. The righteous man. And then in chapter 2, notice what he does. After they were married and they have the visit by the wise men from the east, and beginning in verse 13, it says, now when they had gone, that is the wise men that had visited them, behold, an angel of the Lord appearing to Joseph in a dream said, get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him. So, what does Joseph do? Does he look around and go, oh man, there's my carpenter shop, and how am I going to pack everything up, and you know, what's going to happen here? No. There's a threat to the family. And so Joseph says, all right, let's pack the donkeys and off we go. You know, and they head down to Egypt. So he had the intent and the motive and everything to protect his family. And so he provided that protection. He was the one who got him up and went. So Joseph gathered the family and they went. Now, you know, I don't know how long they were in Egypt. It could have been anywhere from a year to a couple of years, 3 years. You know, he had to start working down there, start providing some sort of sustenance for his family. And yet there comes a point, and just a little bit later, beginning verse 41, in verse 21, that he was told, okay, it's safe, move back to Israel. And he moved back to Nazareth. It's kind of a small, out-of-the-way place. But it was a place where he could set up shop, and he could provide for his family and take care of them. And so we see Joseph as a really good example of the things that he's doing with his family. How about this visit to Jerusalem in Luke, the second chapter, verse 41? Why in the world was the whole family packed up and going to Jerusalem? Well, that was part of Joseph being a devout person. They were required to make these pilgrimages to Jerusalem. And his son was old enough now, being along 12, that it was time to get him involved. There's no accident that Jesus was going along with him. This was on purpose, that he needed to be introduced. At the age of 12, it would have been about when he would have been starting some heavy training and what it meant. And that's why I think they were really surprised when Jesus was in the temple and they were teaching to him. And they said, boy, they couldn't believe what all they already knew. See, a lot of kids would have had some training by that age, but not necessarily much. And Jesus already knew a lot. Now, part of that was probably him being the Son of God. But you have to wonder how much was the training that he was going to get from Joseph and Mary as they had to raise him as a child. We don't think of that often as Jesus being a child. But he was put in good hands. And it's an interesting thing. And then, looked over in Mark, the sixth chapter. There's a statement there. When Jesus had begun his ministry, and there's two renditions of this, but I chose Mark's on purpose. In Mark 6 and in verse 3, Mark 6 and verse 3, he had been teaching there at Nazareth, back in his hometown. And he was at the Sabbath, and he's teaching in the synagogue, and many people were astonished listening to him. But others looked at it and said, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James, and Joseph, and Judas, and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. He was home, and they thought he was getting a little uppity there. But what did they call him? He said, is this not the carpenter? The son of the carpenter is what the other gospel calls it, but this one calls him the carpenter. Why would it say both the son of the carpenter and the carpenter? Do you ever think about Jesus learning a trade? He didn't start his ministry until he was 30. What did he do from the time he was 12 until the time he was 30? He was a carpenter. He worked in his dad's trade, which means dad taught him. Right? That's how you got the trade back then, was the father passed it along to the son. Now, you know, I don't know what Joseph knew or didn't know or had in mind here or what he was thinking. And I'm not sure later if, you know, we don't know how long Joseph lived. And there's some indication as we go that we just don't see any mention of him when Jesus starts his ministry. So there's some thinking that he might have died, you know, somewhere before Jesus started his ministry. But can you imagine, you know, finding out later that you were teaching the Son of God to be a carpenter? You know, to make chairs and wheels and whatever else the carpenter made? But that was the trade. And so Joseph provided that for his son. And now look at that list. There were other children involved. Jesus was not even his natural son, but he treated him as his son. And then he lists these other sons, and one of them there is James, who wound up being one of the pillars in the church in Jerusalem. So not only do we have him being the father of Jesus, but also wind up being the father of someone who was a great influence in the church in Jerusalem. So I think we get a reasonably good example here of someone that we don't often think about as being a good role model as a father. So what are the primary responsibilities? I think we can kind of break things down into three groups here. Provide, protect, and guide. Let's look at provide for a minute. In Proverbs, the 13th chapter, verse 22, Proverbs 13, 22, there's an interesting statement there. It says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. I think what that's talking about is providing for your family and for your children. And it doesn't mean you're not good if you can't leave an inheritance that goes past a couple of generations. But the thought there is that that's what they're working towards. They're working towards to make sure that their family is provided for. 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter and verse 8. Now, the discussion there in 1 Timothy is on widows. But there's a statement in the middle there where it says, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So it's clear that one of the responsibilities that fathers have is in providing for their family. Now, unfortunately, that's where a lot of people don't even get started. There are a lot of fathers in this world who are very happy to share half of their DNA with a mother, and that's kind of the end of it. Why else do we have such a problem with things like child support and all of those kinds of things in the country? People who aren't taking on the responsibility of part of what it means, if you're going to be a father, it's more than just biology. There's responsibility there. But you know, there's another side to the provide thing too. Too many people get hung up on that one. So many people are so busy trying to provide that they don't have anything else to do with the family. So as with many things, there's a balance here. And when he talks about providing for your family, he's not saying that you got to be rich. There's nothing that says you're not a good father if you're not rich. What do we need? Well, we need a place to stay. We need clothes. We need food to eat. You can provide those things. You're doing what you're supposed to. You provide for your family. We need to understand the balance there. Not on the one hand where there's no provision, or when the provision becomes the only thing. We've got to understand the balance. And protect. Mark the 5th chapter, 21 to 23. When Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him, and so he stayed by the seashore. And one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up, and on seeing him, fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she may get well and live. That's very poignant, isn't it? What's he doing there? He's trying to protect his child. And there's a synagogue leader who may not necessarily be in a position to fully agree with maybe what Jesus is teaching. We know that that was a difficult time that Jesus had in many of the synagogues. And yet when his daughter needed help, he went to the place that he thought he could get help. He was there to protect his child. But this is another balance, isn't it? Can you overprotect children? I think you can. I don't know how many people saw this 2020 thing the other night, or even might have seen it in the newspaper or whatever, but this father who was really wanting to protect his sons, six sons, kept them locked in a four-room apartment for 14 years. Now, usually when you hear something about like that, you think, oh, man, you know, what neglect and whatnot. No, I mean, they homeschooled them. He provided for them in terms of, you know, clothes and food, and they didn't really lack anything. It, from all indications, it was a loving family. But he just kept telling them, don't go outside the door because it's really dangerous out there. And there's bad people out there. 14 years before they surfaced and made their way into the world. What's interesting is reading a little bit about them, and it's kind of fascinating, and that's one of the things that was part of the tortured path of getting to this lesson, was thinking, wow, you know, I think the father might have had good intentions, but it's probably not the right way to do things. Fortunately, I think they'll turn out to be okay. We'll see. But you need to protect your family, but do it within the guidelines that God has set. And then there's guide. Now, most people would just know that at this point in the sermon, I'm going to quote Deuteronomy 6. But I'm not going to do that this time. I'm going to fool you. Let's go over to Ephesians, the 6th chapter, verses 1 through 4. You notice that I did bring it up, and you're all going to think about it, and you're all going to know what it means. But in Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 4, we find a number of different statements there about family relationships. It says, children, obey your parents in the Lord. Now, we used to quote that a lot, for this is right. Honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath or to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. Now, this is one of the few very direct statements that we have in the New Testament scriptures about a specific responsibility that fathers have, where it says, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. Now, I used to wonder why that was there. And I'm hoping that we didn't do that too much with our kids in terms of provoking the anger. But I think part of it has to do with, okay, guys, you know, we got to get honest here. Being a guy partly is being in control, right? And having things set up like we want them and organized like we want them. It's a guy thing. And sometimes kids aren't exactly that way. They've got their own opinion about what they want to do and how they want to do it and how they're going to run around. And part of our process is to mold them and to teach them. That's certainly part of this guidance. But when he says, fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath, I think part of what he's talking about there is be very careful how you do that. Be very careful how you do that. Because it's really easy to get carried away and go, all right, folks, it's my way or the highway. And fathers, he's saying, yeah, you just got to be careful with that. You teach your children, you guide your children, but you don't provoke them to anger. There's a very similar passage in Colossians, the 3rd chapter. And he adds a couple of interesting things there where he says, wives, be subject to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. Children, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not exasperate your children so that they will not lose heart. Now, there's two things in there that have to deal with the family relationship, being the father. First thing it says is husbands are to love their wives. In this day and age, we've talked about love before on some things like that. Everybody has a little different opinion that love is just this, you know, sort of gushy thing that you either have or you don't have, and it can fall on you, and then somehow you can fall out of it and lose it, you know, and it's almost like a tangible object that bounces around. In this case, he's saying, husbands, love your wives. Guys, you don't have a choice. You have to. That's what it says. Love your wives. And there's a lot involved in that, and that's one of the first things you have to do in establishing being a good father, is love the wife. And get the family together. But then he does the same kind of thing where he says, don't exasperate your children. Now, there are times when your children will be exasperated. There will be times when you're having a discussion with them, trying to provide guidance, where they don't necessarily agree with the guidance. And my daughter is famous for having said, "But you're not listening." Where she would give me her explanation, then I would explain why that still didn't fit the particular rules and things, and then we would go back and forth a few times in good discussions, and then she would say, "But you're not listening." Exasperated. But that's kind of not what it's talking about there. It's talking about the home environment that you set and whether those children are comfortable in that home environment. And you, as a father, are responsible for setting part of the tone for that home environment. And part of that is making sure your children are comfortable there and not exasperated. 1 Thessalonians, the second chapter, verses 8 through 12. Paul is talking to the church there in Thessalonica when he says, "Having so fond an affection for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you had become very dear to us. For you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaimed to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behaved toward you believers, just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children, so that you would walk in a manner worthy of the God who calls you into his kingdom and glory." Now, he doesn't specifically talk there about fathers and children in a way, and yet he does. Notice all of these things that he says about how they treated the people there and how they worked hard and they tried to work with them and they were concerned about them, just as a father would their child. And so we can look at those entities and say, oh, that's what a father should do. There's a description for you. Laboring, the hardship, working night and day, proclaiming the gospel of God, all of those things are things that they would have done to their own children. Turn over to 1 Timothy, the third chapter, 1 Timothy 3. Because there's a statement here that I think kind of puts a lot of this in perspective and makes a good summary here. 1 Timothy, the third chapter. These are the qualifications for elders and deacons. And there's an interesting statement. You'll recognize it when we get there. I'm just going to read the first 12 verses. "It is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. An overseer then must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert, so that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. He must have a good reputation with those outside the church, so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued or addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain, but holding the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. These men must also first be tested, and then let them serve as deacons if they are beyond reproach. Women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things. And deacons must be husbands of only one wife and good managers of their children and their household. For those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a high standing and great confidence in the faith that is in Christ Jesus." Did you notice the two things there? It's interesting because for the elders, he says, he needs to keep his children under control with all dignity and know how to manage his household. Because if he can't manage his household, how's he going to manage a congregation, a group? And then look at what he says about the deacons. He says they have to be good managers of their children in their household, because they're going to be serving other people and trying to manage a lot of things in the congregation as well. And all of these qualities that he's put down for elders and deacons there, you know what? They're really, and this is really the crux of it, they're really qualities that God wants to see in all of us. They're the qualities he wants for a person who's going to be a father of a family or have an influence on a family. So it's not like if you don't want to be an elder or you don't want to be a deacon, you can kind of go through the list and go, oh, good, I don't have to do any of these. No, that's not the point. The point is that everyone should strive to these because this makes us more like God. And as Joe mentioned this morning, this is our Father's Day, is it not? And so really, maybe, we only have a few really good examples because we can look to the Father as our best example. And here, as he's told about the people who are going to be in his family and taking care of his family, there's a good picture of the types of attributes that a father should have. And I think it boils down to those things. We provide, we protect, we guide. You can't do one without the others and still kind of fulfill your responsibilities. It's like a lot of things. It's a lot of things all wrapped up in one. And it's a scary thing in a lot of ways. You know, how many of you, the fathers, haven't thought many, many times about whether you're doing the right thing at the right time? It's kind of tough sometimes to understand what you're going to do. I really, really wished that when the child came forth from the womb, there was an instruction manual taped to the back. Guys aren't good at reading instruction manuals anyway, so it probably wouldn't do us any good. But you kind of wish that sometimes, don't you? Because every child is different. And it's part of what we have to do as fathers to understand that difference. But let's look to our Heavenly Father. Let's look to the example that Jesus set. Let's look to the example that Joseph set for us as good ones. And you know, we can learn from the bad ones too. There's plenty of things there that we can look at and go, okay, we see their mistakes. That's why they're written down, so that we can see them. And we can know that, that's probably not a good thing. It didn't work out multiple times for those folks. It won't work out for you either. Father's Day. It's a great day, and I hope that each of us has a great day, but that we think about the responsibilities, whether you are a father, were a father, or thinking about being a father. And it's a lot to consider as you move forward into a very, very tough part of your life, but a very rewarding part of your life. If you're not a member of God's family, then you need to have him as your father. You need to accept Jesus as the Son of God, as essentially our elder brother, who came and gave his life for you. And if you want to do that this morning, we give you that opportunity. If you need the prayers or the help of this congregation in any way, please let us know. Please come while we together we stand and sing.